everyone. Thank you for joining the latest edition of the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. As always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Brian Nix and Stuart Salters. Today, we have an incredible guest, Mr. Christopher Guth. Christopher has served in Washington for many years, previously working for the U.S. House of Representatives, Legislative Counsel and Policy Advisor. Also served at the U.S. Department of Energy as the Deputy Assistant Secretary, and currently serves as the Senior Vice President at the Global Energy Institute for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Christopher, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Adam. Excited to do this.
Well, let's dig into some questions here. Stuart, you want to kick us off there?
Christopher, you and I have worked together, so I've known you for many years now and appreciate what you're doing at the U.S. Chamber. Got a little bit of bio from Adam, but maybe to start the call and start the conversation, tell us a little bit more. Who did you work for in the House? What did you do at DOE? What do you do there at the Chamber? Flesh that out a little bit for us.
Sure. I'm a lawyer by trade. After law school, I practiced a couple years, but I'd always been a political and campaign involved. So I went to the Hill. I was, let us say, the director for Bob Barr, who represented a district in the Atlanta suburbs. While I was there, was right about when my home state, California, was having significant electricity issues, lots of rolling blackouts. And it's when it kind of dawned on me that, you know, energy affects every business, every person. And I made this sort of decision that I wanted to focus on that at least more, if not exclusively. And then he lost his reelection, and I ended up going to the Chamber, working in the environment and energy shop at the time. I wasn't there very long. I was able to go work on the 04 Bush-Cheney reelect for a year, which was fascinating. If you ever get a chance to work on a presidential campaign, I definitely recommend doing it. And then I went to DOE as an appointee, first in the Office of Congressional Affairs, where we worked on the Energy Policy Act of 2005 that definitely transformed the energy landscape in many ways. And then at the end of the Bush administration, I wasn't planning on it, but I went back to the Chamber where they had just launched this Global Energy Institute. And I think next week is my 18th year, so it's been a while. But I've been able to be a generalist, but do enough of it that my depth of knowledge has gotten a little bit deeper on everything. But that's my story.
Just one quick follow up, and then I'll turn to one of my colleagues. What is the Global Energy Institute? What do you guys do? Tell me a little bit more about that.
So the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, many people are familiar with it, not everyone. It's the largest trade association in the world. We represent tens of thousands of businesses all over the country, all over the world, every size, every sector. And the Global Energy Institute is the arm of the chamber that handles all things energy and environment. So we have a team of 13 subject matter experts, and it's basically our charge to be able to address any issue within the energy environment space that a business could possibly care about.
So, Chris, what's one of the most surprising things you've learned since working in this kind of field, in this space, especially, you know, politically?
How partisan it's become, but yet there's still, I think, probably more areas of bipartisanship than disagreement. And I guess the real big thing is just how interconnected the world has become. You know, even in a short 25-year period, energy trade has expanded significantly, especially for the U.S. And then I guess more than anything, as a non-technical person, how technical the industry is and how tied to innovation it is. And it, you know, there are surprises around every corner, and some of them you can foresee, but most of them you can't.
Do you feel like it's difficult? Because I agree with you 100%, right? And so much of our energy industry is just tied to innovation. Do you feel like it's kind of a disconnect, usually, how slow politics and the government responds to these things, but how kind of key they are in the energy industry to kind of move it forward?
Yeah. I mean, constitutionally, that's the way it was designed. And it saves us most of the time. But when you're in a crisis, especially an energy crisis, it can be a, it can be frustrating. And it, like I said, there's more consensus than not, but everybody wants to focus on the part where there's not, which is fun, but it's sometimes less productive. And, you know, you brought up innovation too. I mean, we have a saying that any transformation, any movement can only go as fast as the pace of innovation. You may have aspirations to go faster, but it's those wonderful physicists and engineers, biologists that really, really drive that pace.
Following up on that, is there anything that you think limits that? And I guess tying it into where you are now at the Global Energy Institute, like, are there any particular efforts that you guys are working on or looking forward to with regards to innovation or policy for that matter?
Yeah, it's kind of become in the last 5 or 6 years, a huge driver in the business community. As, you know, going back to like the late 2015 to 2020 period, you know, a political wind pushing business towards lowering emissions, and then, you know, shareholders and employees. And it really became, you know, imperative to really double down on that. And we saw some really prescient legislation that was very bipartisan passed in 2020, known as the Energy Innovation Act of 2020. It really kind of changed the paradigm when it comes to the federal government's role in innovation. Not many people know this, but we have 13 national labs that have pretty much either invented or perfected every form of energy and platform that we use. You know, going all the way back to the creation of the first atomic bomb in Los Alamos, New Mexico. And so what the Energy Innovation Act of 2020 did was address what is known as the Valley of Death. We have all these great technologies that these brilliant scientists and engineers develop, both in industry, but also in the labs. But nobody wants to be the first one out of the chute, because you have first of a kind problems in that you don't really know how long it's going to take. I mean, you can estimate the best you want, but if you've never done it before, you're probably going to be wrong, and you don't know what the cost is going to be. So a lot of these technologies never made it to market. And so what Congress did was they said, all right, DOE, here's $80 billion to go out and be the first mover. Go build the first and second small modular reactor. And then industry can crib off of that. And they have certainty, or far more certainty in the actual development and construction of it. Go build hydrogen hubs so that we can perfect the platforms and build out a hydrogen economy. Carbon capture and storage, something that is increasingly sought after by industry. And it hasn't been fully implemented yet, but it basically socialized that risk, that cost across the entire US tax base. And that was something that, you know, even a few years before that, Republicans weren't too keen on. But I think it just speaks to the evolution of the politics around some of these technologies. I mean, if you would have told me in 2019 that the presidential nominee for the Democratic Party was going to run on a platform that pushed nuclear and CCS, I wouldn't have believed you. But to President Biden's credit, he did, and his Department of Energy really leaned into it. So we're going back to my original or earlier point. There's a lot of consensus on a lot of this.
In that pool, I guess, that you referenced, is there any particular technologies or projects or energy sectors that you're looking forward to or that you see kind of coming about?
Well, definitely small modular reactors. They've been talked about for, you know, 40 years. They've gotten really hot as of late, as we start to see electricity demand growth for the first time in a generation. And especially within the tech sector, building data centers, you know, they all have ESG commitments. And so they need more electrons, but they don't want emissions to come with them. So I think we're very, very close. But in spite of all of the investment into, you know, new companies that are developing this technology, there still really hasn't been anyone to buy one yet. I mean, there's only one that has a design certification from the NRC. So we'll see. And frankly, some of them might be too small given the scale of the expected electricity demand growth. We saw some coverage this week from DOE announcing a loan guarantee for some long lead items, things like heavy forgings and pressure vessels, with the hope that somebody pulls the trigger on a traditional, you know, full-scale light water reactor, which is something that is very exciting, but it's very risky, or at least it's perceived as very risky from an economic standpoint, not from a safety standpoint, because the last two that we built took longer and were more expensive than projected, because it was the first time they built that reactor. So now they have two reactors under their belt, but you know, the finance industry looks at building more a little askew. So I would say, I mean, that's probably my favorite, having worked in the Office of Nuclear Energy at DOE. But I'm also really excited about fusion. You know, Secretary Wright has a master's degree in nuclear engineering and spent the first 20 years of his career at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab working on fusion before he went into the oil and gas industry. And, you know, he's convinced that the pace of development of generative AI is really helping the scientists and engineers answer, you know, engineering questions that, you know, in a matter of seconds that would have taken him, you know, 6 months. And so, you know, if we can bring more fission online and then couple that with fusion, I mean, that's really going to put us in the driver's seat, more in the driver's seat.
I think Secretary Wright is either in Idaho or going to Idaho to visit the national lab where they're doing a lot of this work. And so there's definitely some emphasis on nuclear technology from this administration, you know, not only this administration, but also the private sector. So it is pretty exciting. And as you think about that energy generation technology, you know, what a lot of GPA midstream members do, they work more in the natural gas space or the crude oil space and that energy generation. Taking all that in, I mean, your perspective is really interesting because you deal a lot with all sectors of the economies, right? Whether it's the chamber, whether it's the Global Energy Institute, y'all have members representing all sectors. And so in that community, do they say we're in an energy transition? How do they frame where we are?
I think, I mean, people who aren't in the energy industry don't appreciate that. At the end of the day, it's really an engineering industry. And I think if you talk to those engineers, they'll tell you that we've been in an energy transition since the dawn of man. You know, innovation happens, new discoveries happen. You know, it's been wrapped within the context of climate change for the last decade. But, you know, that innovation is happening, and we've seen the fruits of that innovation, both from an energy security standpoint, but also from an emissions reduction standpoint. I mean, we've reduced emissions more than any other country in the world by far through innovation. And, you know, certainly some of it has to do with the massive deployment of wind and solar, but really the overwhelming majority of it comes from using natural gas as our predominant source of electricity. So yeah, there is an energy transition. There's always going to be an energy transition. And that's a good thing because that means we're progressing through innovation.
So Christopher, just kind of looking out in the future, let's say we can kind of adopt a lot of this nuclear power and, you know, keep transitioning energy, keep generating more. One of the things that I find interesting is, you know, the concept of energy independence in America, right? So we, you know, we produce a lot of energy, right? We consume some, we produce a lot of it. One thing we saw with the Iran war and the strait closures, gas prices going up. Obviously, we have global markets of a lot of our energy. Is energy independence an actual real thing, in your opinion? Like, can we generate enough and segregate ourselves enough to not be fluctuated by those global markets? Or do you think there's always going to be that kind of push and pull?
I think it's a good concept, but at the end of the day, it's more about energy security. And frankly speaking, you know, if we put a fence around the country and didn't have relatively open trade, prices would go up. I mean, we're a net oil exporter, which is great, but we still import about 20% of all the crude that we refine and then ultimately we put in our vehicles from Canada. And, you know, it's because they produce a type of oil that our brilliant engineers can refine into the gasoline and diesel and jet fuel that every other refinery can. But because it's really thick and viscous, it's harder. And that means that they get to buy it at a discount. So that makes them more profitable. And then a lot of the crude that we produce is light sweet. It's not viscous and it's a lot easier to refine. And so a lot of other countries don't have the sophisticated refineries. They depend on that because it's easier to refine. So it's sort of like we buy Budweiser, but we sell Dom Perignon. And it really, really works well. And then you look at things like critical minerals that are so critical to the economy, but also specifically the energy industry. We have more than we know what to do with, but we can't get out of our own way when it comes to actually producing and refining them and turning them into the products that we use every day. I mean, we're roughly 90% dependent upon China for the minerals themselves, but perhaps even worse, for that 10% we're not, we still have to ship 90% of it to China to get processed. And this is a huge geopolitical risk. And we've seen China use it as a cudgel in that they just, the snap of a finger, decide to stop exporting certain minerals and certain products to the U.S. And these are minerals that are almost exclusively used by the Pentagon and the defense contractors that build all of the munitions and platforms that we rely on to keep the U.S. and our allies safe. So, you know, being able to kind of knock that down, I mean, I think the stat is like over the last 60 years, the average time it took to permit a mine is 36 years. That's just ridiculous because we have the most sustainable mines in the world, but, you know, we're still in that spot. This administration has leaned into it heavily. They've permitted, I think, 4 mines already, and one of them, they did it in 18 days. You know, that's revolutionary, but, you know, we're getting there, but it goes back to my point that without the energy trade, we wouldn't be able to make deals with our allies like Canada and Australia to acquire more of these important minerals and reduce our dependence on China. So I think it really comes down to energy security, and energy security is really dependent upon free and fair trade.
Now, so what do you think the biggest threat is to our energy security? Do you think it's minerals or something else?
Well, right now, yeah, for sure. It's minerals. I think the biggest real threat is us. I mean, our permitting process is broken. It shouldn't take longer to permit a project than it does to build it. But that's where we are now. I mean, the last time the government did an audit in Trump 1, they found that if you trigger the federal permitting process, which is not hard to do, it takes on average 5 years to get through. And that's the average. I already mentioned the ridiculous mine one that's 36 years. It takes 7 years for an airport. And I'm not talking like building a new airport. I'm talking about like adding a new restroom on, you know, an extension on a terminal. And this is something that is really important to the chamber. We've made it our number one legislative priority for the last 2 or 3 years. And, you know, you and I come at it from the pipelines and transmission line standpoint. But I have other colleagues who come at it from the roads and bridges standpoint. And then there's things that people don't really think of, like rural broadband. I mean, if you don't live in a, you know, decent sized city, your life depends on reliable internet for telehealth, for telework. And if a new tower is being built in a rural area, it gets partially funded by a federal program, which triggers the federal permitting process. And it works pretty good, you know, 92, 93% of the time, but that's little solace to the other 7% who are lacking that, you know, that basic function that we all rely on so much, even if we're in a city, but especially if you're not in a city. So, you know, getting these things built is key to make to keep our economy competitive and to drive us into the future. I mean, the permitting right now, obviously affordability is the top political issue, primarily because of inflation over the last 6 years. And I don't remember who it was. I should know this. I want to say the Breakthrough Institute. They did a study and found that, you know, the permitting process adds something like $130 billion to these projects every year. And those additional costs get passed on to us. And that's additional inflationary pressure. So if we can knock down the time to a reasonable, predictable time frame while still ensuring that the permitting process works to protect people and the environment, I mean, that's going to really set us apart, because this is a pox on everyone's house. Unless it's a state-controlled economy like Russia and China, you know, permitting sucks everywhere. I mean, Canada has problems, Europe has problems, Australia has problems. So it would be great to set us apart and maybe lead by example.
You brought up data center, you know, the evolution of the data centers that are going in, and now we're talking about permitting and affordability. You know, a lot of people have been protesting the data centers and doing that kind of stuff, but it's become really a fad to go behind the meter. Is your group tracking that, and what role do you guys kind of play if it circumvents that traditional utility type application?
Yeah, I mean, we have members all over the place on this issue. I mean, I guess the reality is it takes too long for interconnection for a lot of the hyperscalers, and so increasingly we're seeing them turn to behind the meter. I think there's been a pretty significant evolution in the last year. I think this time last year, of all the announced data centers, a third of them were grid connected, a third of them were behind the meter, and a third of them were both, so that if they have surplus electrons, they can sell it back to the grid. And also, so they have additional redundancies for reliability. And the whole behind the meter concept, it's taken off. And we're seeing folks in the oil and gas industry get into the power business. Like, look, we're an engineering company. We know how to produce power. And oh, by the way, we have a lot of natural gas. I mean, Chevron just announced a deal with Microsoft where they're going to build, at least initially, a 2.5 gigawatt natural gas plant with the possibility of going up to 5 gigawatts, which, you know, to put in context, a full scale or a full size nuclear reactor is around 1100 or 1200 megawatts or 1.1, 1.2 megawatts. And then all of a sudden we're talking about a 5 gigawatt power plant. So it's evolving very quickly, you know, kind of fun to watch the technology itself and AI really move the pace of innovation faster. But to your point about kind of the affordability and opposition, we look at it as an imperative to build out the data centers here, not just from a geopolitical standpoint, but from an economic competitiveness standpoint. I mean, our CEO has charged us to view every policy, regulation, law through the lens of, does it help achieve sustained 3% growth, which is a great North Star for us. And so if you look at the economy over the last year, it's kind of started to bifurcate with the industrials not doing so well. Manufacturing had two consecutive quarters of negative growth, some parts of it even worse. And historically, the industrials have been kind of the heartbeat of the economy. And so you would think that our economy is tanking if the industrials are, but it's not. I mean, we had 4.2% growth in the fourth quarter and 2% growth in the second quarter. And I mean, the paradigm is that the tech industry is really floating much of the economy right now. And it's because so much money is flowing into the development of generative AI, and you need data centers for AI. So we need data centers for 3% growth. Now, we've seen the sort of opposition kind of spread like wildfire. And I've been saying this for 6 months, but now it's been conclusively proven. The Chinese are behind a lot of it. There was a report that came out 2 weeks ago from OpenAI, the company that created and developed ChatGPT. They went into kind of their model, and they were able to find over 80 instances where individuals in China used ChatGPT to generate anti-data center content. And then it goes on, you know, TikTok and Instagram. And, you know, I don't spend a lot of time on social media, but when I do go and look at this stuff sometimes, and it's almost all nonsense. But people see it and then they believe it. It's like data centers are going to pollute the water. They're going to have all these emissions. They're going to jack up electricity rates. None of those things are accurate. And since you asked about electricity rates and affordability, I think 2 days ago, EPRI, which is kind of like a think tank that supports the electric industry, they came out with a study and found that areas that have high concentrations of data centers have lower prices. I mean, because the Public Utility Commission basically negotiates deals with the hyperscalers to ensure that they're paying more than their fair share. I mean, I live in Northern Virginia, which is the capital of data centers, more data centers here than anywhere else in the world. Our rates haven't gone up. And other places that don't have any data centers have seen them go up. So this is, again, one of those strategic mistruths that the Chinese are spreading, because they don't want us to be in the lead when it comes to AI. They want it for themselves, because, I mean, it's a geopolitical benefit for them. And, you know, given that this is an oil and gas audience, you know, I survived the fracking wars of, you know, 2010 to 2015, and the parallels are uncanny. You know, industry was kind of slow to do the community outreach and the blocking and tackling, and frankly, you know, rejecting that they needed a social license to operate. They finally got their stuff together, but there was all kinds of nonsense being spread about fracking. You know, fracking's going to start your sink on fire. Fracking's going to kill your cows or grow a third arm on your child. Obviously, none of that was true, and the last 15 years have demonstrated that. But U.S. intelligence community was able to demonstrate conclusively that Russia was funding a lot of that anti-fracking movement. And the one, I guess, distinction that I can see between the fracking fights and the data center fights is social media was nascent back then. And now it's ever present. And people digest probably 95% of their news on social media. And if there's no way to tell that this is Chinese propaganda, sounds good. You know, I don't want dirty air. I don't want water issues. I don't want higher electricity rates, but they're all wrong. And so it's about, you know, the business community getting out there and explaining these things and partnering with strange bedfellows like organized labor in the like law enforcement or teachers or nurses, because they're the ones that really benefit. You know, when data centers come in, especially these large hyperscaler data centers, they increase tax revenue significantly. And when you go out to Loudoun County, where, you know, that big concentration is, they have some of the newest and shiniest hospitals and schools anywhere in the country. And, you know, it's a challenge to even find a pothole out there, because they have so much additional revenue from these data centers, and helping communities understand that they're going to have better schools, they're going to have better hospitals, they're going to have better supported first responders. I mean, that's really the primary driver behind it.
So many great points there. One thing I'll add, had the opportunity to meet the executive director or head of the Conway Chamber of Commerce. And there's a data center project proposed for outside of Conway, north of Little Rock, Arkansas. And he was like, yo, like the tax revenue this project will bring in is like double our city budget existing or something crazy like that. And so, but it was interesting. He, you know, of course, had an opposition person come to him, opponent come to him and say, you know, they only build these data centers next to like low income housing. And so he went to Google Maps and pulled up Loudoun County and showed on Google Maps how you have a data center, and it's not next to low income housing. It's next to like, you know, $1 million home, horse farms, you know, crazy stuff that folks out in Loudoun County, you know, big acreage, big farms, big houses. And so that's not the case, but it's an opportunity. But I think, you know, like you said, they messed up on some of the messaging, and I think they're getting it, hopefully, coming around.
Yeah, I think they're bending over backwards. They're basically saying, what is it going to take for you to want us to be here? You know, we saw maybe last week, there was a Wall Street Journal article talking about how this new Meta data center in Monroe, Louisiana, which is a pretty ruralish area. This year, the school district gave $50,000 bonuses to every teacher. And the highest income of any one of the teachers was $52,000. So they doubled their salary overnight because of that data center.
That's crazy. Well, I know we're getting close to ending. You've given more of your time than we probably deserve, but I did want to ask you one more question. I guess as we think about this interplay, you know, where the U.S. sits with exporting oil, I like the Budweiser and the Dom Perignon. That's good. I might have to steal that one. But as we export our Dom Perignon and we import our Budweiser, do we have enough infrastructure? Do we have enough capability to do this effectively?
I mean, we have enough right now, but it goes back to my permitting comment. I mean, it's nearly impossible to site an interstate natural gas pipeline. I mean, it took a literal act of Congress to get the Mountain Valley Pipeline approved. In December of 2024, we partnered with Dan Yergin at S&P Global and did a series of studies around the impacts of exporting natural gas on domestic prices. And what they found was that even if the expected doubling in export capacity between 2025 and 2030 happens, it would have a negligible impact on price. And to get to your question, a side case that we had them do is, what would happen to prices in New England and New York if additional trunk lines were built from the Marcellus? I mean, New England pays the highest electricity rates in the country, even though they're 200 miles away from the second largest natural gas field in the world. And it's because, you know, politicians have prevented new pipelines from being built. So what it found was that if those additional pipelines were built, city gate prices in New York would decline by 32% and New England by 24%. I mean, that's pretty significant, especially when you're talking about affordability. So, you know, we have enough in most places, but we need more. We have more natural gas than we know what to do with, but you have to be able to move those molecules. And, you know, we're in the process of scoping a follow-up study that would look at infrastructure being built all over, going west, going south, going north, to really demonstrate that the infrastructure constraint is the biggest reason why energy prices aren't lower than they are.
Well, I'll reiterate what Stuart said. Thank you so much for your time. I feel like we could talk for another hour.
It's fun.
But as we wrap, we always like to ask folks, you know, you're on this podcast again in 3 years from now, and you come back and you're happy about what's gone on. What over the past 3 years has happened to make you happy at where you are and what's going on?
Well, first and foremost, Congress passes meaningful permit reform. I mean, that's going to, you know, pave the way to so many other things and to keep prices down. But I also think that if the electricity demand that's forecasted materializes, and we're already starting to see it, I think demand's up 3.2% year on year. You know, you're going to see the pace of innovation really accelerate, and you know we're going to have seen new reactors ordered and started, and with permitting reform, we're going to see, you know, new infrastructure like natural gas pipelines to move those molecules to the places where it needs to be. And we're going to see new transmission lines. I mean, as bad as it is to site a natural gas pipeline, it's even worse for an interstate transmission line. I mean, there's four projects in the desert Southwest to take electrons from massive, like the largest in the country, solar fields in the middle of nowhere from New Mexico, Nevada, and Arizona into Southern California, where, you know, you got millions of people who live there. Of those four projects, two of them took 16 years. One of them took 17 years. And the fourth one is at 20 years and it's still not approved yet. I mean, that's just nuts. We need to be able to get those electrons around, and we need every electron we can get, whether it's wind, nuclear, coal, or gas, in order to keep pace with rising demand. So I'm optimistic we're going to see a lot of great changes in the next 3 years.
Well, good. We hope to have you on again, and we'd love to have you on again here coming up. But again, thank you for your time. Everybody, Christopher Goose, appreciate you.